Cautionary Tales, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Senator Al Franken says he will resign following allegations of sexual misconduct. A reporter from the Middle East says the story has her thinking about her own workplace.
I think that people would make comments about how you look and what you're wearing and in ways that it would not be acceptable in the United States. In many ways, it's as if it's still 1950 in the Arab world.
And this correspondent in France remembers a colleague who was pinched twice by a French president.
I said, you should have taken his hand and raised it up above him and said, Mr. President, could you please get your hand off my butt? Excuse me, I don't know if that's okay for public radio.
Sure is. The global view on America's sexual harassment scandals ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. All this week, we're asking you to flip your tag on the shirt or skirt or jeans that you're wearing right now and think about who made it. Chances are it was made by a woman. Women do most of the work in the global garment industry. So what do these jobs mean for these women? More financial stability? Access to education? Our Across Women's Lives team traveled to Bangladesh to find some answers to those questions. And we begin today's show with this story from The World's Jasmine Garst.
Sometimes Rangmala Begum wonders. There isn't a lot of time to stop and think at a garment factory. Too many needles and scissors and glue guns to look up and ponder the irony of global capitalism. That a woman in a subtropical country would spend her days and her nights making sweaters. But Rangmala says on occasion she looks at the sweaters and thinks, who is going to wear this? The answer is the whole world. The world's clothing gets made mostly in China, and at its heels is Bangladesh, with a workforce that is 85% women. Rangmala, like many of the women who make your clothing, is ageless, meaning she doesn't have a birth certificate, which is common for the rural poor here. She thinks she's in her 40s. She tells me she's from Sherpur, a district bordering India. At some point several years ago, she did what village girls fleeing poverty do here in Bangladesh. She came to Dhaka, the capital, and got work at a factory. Rangmala started making a little over $3 a month. She and her husband were able to rent a room, but they were stretched thin, especially when they started having kids. That's when Rangmala found work at the sweater factory where she is now. She says she can make as much as $70 a month, which is enough to get by, but nothing more. Like most workers, Rangmala's official shift is 8 to 5, but no one I speak to actually works that shift. Rangmala tries to stay till midnight. If she works a 16-hour day, she gets a bonus of about 60 cents. Rangmala says the work is exhausting, but unlike her husband, a day laborer, she's able to save a little bit of money. She says her life here in Dhaka is definitely better than in the village. Even though factory work gave her a better life, Rangmala didn't want her teenage daughter, Maina, working here. It's just too grueling. But Maina says she wanted to help her family, and at age 12, she dropped out of school and headed for a polo shirt factory. This is Maina. She's 16 now. Unlike her mother, she can read and she can write. She works a bit less than her mother, about 12 hours a day, and she makes around the same amount of money. She says it's not that bad. Rangmala interjects to say she worries about Maina. The city feels dangerous, and she doesn't like Maina coming back home from work at night. We travel in a big group. It's really okay, says Maina. This back and forth is classic mother-daughter fare in any country. But underlying it is Rangmala's anguish about what working in the garment factory is doing for her teenage daughter. Maina is certainly better off than Rangmala was. She's literate, she's making money, and there's food on the table. But mother and daughter combined work 180 hours a week. And what do they have to show for it? Meager savings. They live in a tiny cement room. So what's the next step for them? Has this family plateaued here at the bare minimum?
We really haven't seen big change in the standard of living of the workers. You see, they're still, they haven't been able to elevate themselves to a certain level. So that is what we need to achieve.
That's Asif Ibrahim. He's not an activist or even a worker. Far from it. He's an industry leader, and he owns several factories. In conversation, he drops a word we love in the West, sustainability. We mostly use it to describe the environment, but Asif Ibrahim says,
sustainability of these marginalized workers so that we can also improve their life standard also has to be at the top of the agenda for everyone concerned.
Okay, great. So why don't guys like Asif Ibrahim just pay workers like the big guns a lot more? He says this is why.
Get 50% off everything at oldnavy.com. Extended through two
holes. Give joy, get joy.
Hurry and save 15% on select items with coupon. JCPenney.
Because retail brands are constantly trying to outdo each other with the lowest prices. It's what consumers want. So when a big brand comes to someone like Asif Ibrahim, they come with a price they are willing to pay for his product.
If the consumer in the West just pays 50 cents more, 50 euro cents more in Europe, or 50 US cents more in the US, and that gets translated into the wage of the workers directly, it can make a big difference in the living standard of the girl who's sewing in a factory in Dhaka or in Cambodia or in Vietnam or any other place.
Any other place. The idea sends shudders down Bangladeshi factory owners' spines. The garment industry has a viral quality to it. It moves from one cheap host country to any other place that is cheaper, faster, and less regulated. Bangladesh is eternally trying to catch up to the giant in the north, China, who has the market cornered. And other Asian countries are always trying to take Bangladesh's place. So nobody here wants to make too many demands that could push the retail companies to go somewhere else. Winter weather in Bangladesh is absolutely perfect. It's exactly warm enough, and the sun is never too distant, but never too scalding. Rangmala and Maina take me for a walk to the market to get some vegetables and maybe some fish. On our way, we stop at a fabric store where they get their clothing made. They ooh and ah at the vibrant colored fabrics. One scarf catches their eye. It's beautifully woven, a rich, dark winter shade. I can't help but check the tag. It says, Made in China. For the World, I'm Jasmine Garst in Dhaka, Bangladesh.
Whatever country our clothing might be made in, we all want to look good, right? But it's not always easy to find fun, fashionable clothing when you have a disability. Doing up a button, tying a shoelace, pulling on a sweater. This stuff can be a daily challenge for people with physical limitations. Victoria Farmer is one of my colleagues with Public Radio International. She's based at PRI headquarters in Minneapolis. And she's written about how the fashion industry rarely gives much thought to people with disabilities. Victoria, what prompted you to write about this topic?
Well, I work in audience development here at PRI. So I was working on an audience survey for this wear and tear series that we're doing. And as I was thinking through the kind of diverse voices that we're trying to highlight in that series, I started thinking about sort of my own experiences, trying to find clothes that fit my body. I have spastic diplegic cerebral palsy, and also make me feel cute and fashionable.
And what's been your experience in trying to find lovely clothing that suits you and that works?
Well, my experience has mostly been about shoes. I can typically wear clothes made for able-bodied people, but I have to wear AFOs, ankle foot orthoses, which are braces that go on my legs. So it's often difficult to find shoes that will fit over the AFOs comfortably, and frankly, that look like they aren't made for your 80-year-old grandmother.
Have you been able to find, you talk about in your piece wanting to find cute shoes, and are companies making more efforts at that? Do you have more choice now than you did, say, 15 years ago?
Yes, that's definitely true, that there are more choices now. When I was a child, the thing I wanted the most was a pair of Converse Chuck Taylors like my big brothers. So those were like the height of cool to me as a kid. And I could never have any because I couldn't fit them over my braces. So Converse has actually recently created a version of their classic One Stars that have elastic laces and a fold down ankle.
It's interesting. I'm curious, in your research and in your own experience, do you think the fashion industry is responding to demand, or is there, within the fashion industry, people are thinking, well, this is a market we should go for?
I definitely think that you can see more mainstream companies putting out adaptive lines, like Tommy Hilfiger, for example. Last year, he did a line for children with various disabilities, like magnetic snaps and sensory-friendly material for children with autism. He and his second wife actually have a child with autism, which is one of the things that he says brought this to his attention. And there are also a number of companies that specialize in adaptive clothing that are starting to gain prominence. One that I found when I was doing research is a Russian couture line called Bezgranits Couture. Bezgranits means without borders in Russian. And they make really beautiful gowns and suits, things that look like they belong on any fashion runway you would see.
Hmm. What struck me about your piece is when you talk about how there's a tendency for people to make clothes for people with disabilities that are definitely function over form and function over beauty. Are the fashion companies that are getting it right, are they tilting more toward, hey, let's just make beautiful clothes, period?
I think they are. And I think a big reason why they're doing that is that the companies that are doing this right are collaborating with people with disabilities themselves, using them as models. They're listening to them about what they need from their clothes, what they need them to do. And I think this kind of collaboration and really engaging with the people who are going to wear the clothes first is a huge step forward.
Victoria Farmer works in audience development for our producing partner, Public Radio International. Thanks, Victoria.
Thanks for having me, Carol.
And you can see a number of the fashions Victoria is talking about at PRI.org. And while you're there, find out how fair is your fashion. Take our quiz. Gay rights advocates won a victory today in Australia. That's what it sounded like in the Australian Parliament today when lawmakers voted to legalize same-sex marriage. The vote followed years of political debate going back to 2004. Some MPs hugged and wiped away tears. Guests in the public gallery broke into the patriotic song, I Am Australian. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is a longtime supporter of gay marriage. Here was his reaction.
What a day for love, for equality, for respect. Australia has done it. Every Australian had their say and they said it's fair. Get on with it. And the Parliament has got on with it. And we have voted today for equality, for love. It's time for more marriages, more commitment. More love, more respect.
Only four lawmakers voted no. The legislation came to Parliament after Australian voters overwhelmingly said yes to same-sex marriage in a national survey. And that support came through at a local bar in the city of Melbourne, where patrons said that today's vote was long overdue.
I'm actually a little disgusted it's taken Australia this long to actually get to this point.
Yeah, I would say that I'm proud that Australia has agreed to pass the law. Yeah, absolutely. It's taken a long time. It's been 10 years of campaigning. It's finally happened, and we all should be proud of it.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I'm very happy that this has sort of happened. It's just, like, taken too long, I think.
It's great news. It couldn't probably move swiftly enough. It's a good day.
The first legal same-sex weddings in Australia are expected in early January. Coming up, reaction from the Middle East to President Trump's declaration on Jerusalem. That's next on The World. I'm Carol Hills, here with The World. We're going to take a few minutes to check in on the latest international reaction to President Trump's announcement yesterday recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and his intention to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv. Palestinians have been protesting in cities across the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. This was Bethlehem earlier today. Those are tear gas canisters being fired by an Israeli armored vehicle. Israeli security forces were responding to protesters throwing stones at them. Dozens of people were injured today in demonstrations across the Palestinian territories. Elsewhere in the Muslim world, there were protests in Tunisia and Pakistan and in U.S. allies like Jordan and Turkey. Wider protests are expected tomorrow, Friday, the Muslim Day of Prayer. Speaking at a conference in Jerusalem today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised Trump's announcement as historic.
I think yesterday was a momentous day, an important one. Jerusalem has an extraordinary history, and over the millennia, you can actually cite a few significant milestones. Yesterday's statement by President Trump, I think, is such a milestone.
Netanyahu said he was, quote, already in contact with other countries to announce a similar recognition, but he did not name any of them. Many Israelis share Netanyahu's enthusiasm, including Jerusalem residents Avigail Strenger and Eli Kashtan.
We're very excited. I think it's a fantastic event. It's been long coming. Jerusalem is de facto been our capital for many, many years, and we're happy to have the recognition from the United States finally.
Historic, definitely historic. We've been waiting for it for a long time. I hope it doesn't get stuck in endless bureaucracy and waivers, and the proof is always in the pudding, but we're very excited about it.
Even some of the prime minister's political opponents gave a guarded welcome, but Palestinians are furious. In Gaza, this woman, who gave her name as Najla, told the BBC that she was stunned by Trump's decision.
I was really shocked, and I was feeling very, very deeply angry inside. And I was actually seeing the news and watching him among people in a supermarket. And everyone was like staring at the screen. I was like, what? He's actually saying it. And everyone was like, this is really insane.
She says it feels like a door has completely closed.
This decision has just came on top of everything to really make us feel that that's it. Even those who are moderate and had believed to some extent in peace as an option, I mean, have thought that, no, that's it.
Hamas, which runs Gaza, is calling for a new intifada. Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon have weighed in, and not surprisingly, they've condemned the U.S. decision. But there's also been strong criticism from U.S. allies like Turkey, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. The Turkish prime minister said the U.S. has, quote, pulled the pin on a bomb ready to blow in the region. In Indonesia, the prime minister warned that the decision was unlawful and could, quote, disturb world peace. And it's not just Muslim allies. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, echoed pretty much every European nation's response when she said this.
The announcement has the potential to send us backwards to even darker times than the ones we are already living in.
But the Trump administration remains adamant. Speaking at a news conference in Vienna, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson reminded his audience of some political facts.
So the president, after many, many reaffirmations by our Senate, including as recently as this past summer in a vote, I think was 90-0 with 10 abstentions, the president is simply carrying out the will of the American people. The reality is Israel's government, its courts, its prime minister's office is all in Jerusalem today. So it is just an acknowledgement of what is reality on the ground.
The Russian government says it wants to make cyberspace safer. The way to do that, according to Moscow, is for Russia to build an independent internet, not just for itself, but several other countries as well. President Vladimir Putin wants it done by August 1st of next year. What Putin has in mind is a domain name system, or DNS. And to explain what that means, we've got Mitch Stoltz on the line. He's with the Electronic Frontier Foundation in California.
The easiest way to think of the DNS is as the internet's telephone book. What computer is connected to the internet, and then that's everything from the massive server farms to your PC or phone. The way they talk to each other is with numbers. Each one of them has a numerical address called an internet protocol address. But those are pretty hard for humans to remember and associate with things. So what the DNS does is it turns domain names like EFF.org into numerical IP addresses, like a telephone book. It's decentralized, so the computers that run the domain name system are all over the world, and every name is unique. So when you type bbc.co.uk, you get to the site you're expecting to get.
So what is Russia proposing to do?
According to the Russian news site RT, Russia is planning to build a parallel system, its own version of the domain name system. Which is interesting because really in order to be useful, it has to be tied in with the main system. You could build an alternative to the DNS. There's nothing magical about the DNS, but it wouldn't be able to reach every site in the world. It would sort of be like printing your own phone book and making up your own phone numbers.
So is the idea that Russia wants to have its own system to communicate among other Russians and among Russian organizations that outsiders can't access?
It sounds like the idea is to build a backup system that isn't dependent on this coordination around the world. And there's a number of reasons why they might do that. Certainly, to run their own system increases their ability to censor websites because they can simply remove its entry from the phone book. They could certainly do a lot more surveillance because really every time you look up a web page or use a mobile app, you're making requests of the DNS system. And so if somebody's there recording those requests, they can tell a lot about who you are and what you're doing.
Can you give me an example of a kind of cyber attack Russia would be able to launch with its own DNS system?
It's possible that Russia could attack the global DNS system and fall back on this backup system that they've built. Now, that's actually pretty far-fetched because the global DNS system is run by thousands of computers all over the world, which would be fairly difficult to attack, but that's a possibility. And they could, for example, for anyone using their DNS system, they could spoof websites. So if you ask your browser to go to whitehouse.gov, it could send you to a fake whitehouse.gov with incorrect information on it. And it would be harder to detect. But again, that would only work for people who are actually participating in their system. What it means is more control in the long term.
You know, Vladimir Putin has an ambitious date for this, which is launching at August 2018. How realistic is that?
That's really probably pretty far-fetched. They can certainly build servers and get them running by August 2018, but changing that over is no trivial matter. You really have to reconfigure every internet-connected device within Russia to talk to that system. That's probably a much longer project.
Mitch Stoltz is with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thanks for speaking with us, Mitch.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Hills. Picture this, a beautiful, pristine Florida beach without a hotel in sight.
And we preserve 40% of our oceanfront in conservation, so it will never be built on, whether it be a single-family home or a hotel.
Well, except for one small hotel, it could be a model for green construction in the face of climate change. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Few could have predicted this turn of events just a few weeks ago.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party.
That, of course, is Senator Al Franken, a Democrat from Minnesota, announcing that in coming weeks he will resign in the wake of sexual misconduct allegations. Franken's case is only one of many where charges of inappropriate behavior toward women are roiling U.S. politics and many other sectors of life. So how's the rest of the world viewing the turmoil? For that, we turn to Muna Shikaki, a correspondent for Al Arabiya News Channel in Washington, D.C., and Elaine Sholino. She's the former Paris bureau chief for The New York Times, and one of her books is La seduction, how the French play the game of life. Muna, I want to start with you. What's your impression of how these revelations are playing in the Mideast? I mean, are they even on the radar screen?
Oh, absolutely. My producers tell me that the stories that we do about this get a lot of viewers, get a lot of attention on social media platforms. And I think that has to do with a couple of factors. First of all, it's something that's viewed from the context of something that's going on in Hollywood. You know, we have figures in the entertainment industry, in the news industry, and politicians in Congress. But it's also viewed through the lens that this happens a lot in the Middle East. It happens a lot in our workplaces, too. But it's very difficult to talk about in the Middle East.
So in a certain way, by it happening here, it pushes forward the conversation there.
Oh, absolutely. It allows us to talk about it.
Elaine, how about in France? Is the story resonating there?
France is the country of seduction in terms of its history, its culture, its political life. Politicians are seducers. But there's a difference between seduction and criminality. And what you have had in France is what I call the bookends, you know, starting with the case in 2011 of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who was then the head of the International Monetary Fund, who was accused of raping a maid in a New York hotel, as one bookend, and that whole case and national soap opera. And now the Weinstein case, which has resonated in France because some of the most famous models and actresses in France are his alleged victims and have come out against him.
But Elaine, I'm wondering how the French are responding to things like Al Franken resigning and the fact that many people's careers are being ruined. And there's a whole range of offenses that have gone on. And say, if you look at, say, Al Franken or Conyers from Michigan, that they're losing their jobs, they're accused and then let go. Do the French distinguish between the Harvey Weinstein offenses and the charges of politicians? And I'm just wondering if they have different responses to them.
That's the key question that I think we're facing in the United States as well as France. There are no definitions for some of these alleged criminal acts. You know, what is street harassment? What is sexual harassment in the workplace?
Muna, in your reporting, are there elements of this story that are difficult to sort of translate to an Arab audience? I mean, I guess what I'm asking, is there anything peculiarly American about it that makes it hard for your audience to fully appreciate?
I think when it comes to things that have to do with the Arab world, there's a lot of conspiracy theories that surround it. For example, a lot of the questions that I get when I do these stories are, why is this all happening now? Is there some big hand that's behind it that's unifying all of these women? And is there some political reason why it's happening right now? There are also questions, though, that mimic questions here about due process. I always get asked about why these people are being fired, but we're not seeing any court cases. And I have to explain there's a difference between sexual harassment, sexual assault, and rape, and that sexual harassment might not be illegal, but it's still something that can get you fired. And I think in the Arab world, where there's not a lot of political correctness, they don't understand that necessarily.
What's an example of that?
I think that people would make comments about how you look and what you're wearing and in ways that it would not be acceptable in the United States. In many ways, it's as if it's still 1950 in the Arab world, especially in, you know, workplaces with women and men together. And on the other hand, on the other side of the spectrum, you also have places that are much more conservative, where it would be considered completely unacceptable to have this collegial relationship with women in the workplace. So you have both in the Arab world.
Elaine, is that true in France as well, that there's a different kind of acceptability of certain things in the workplace?
Well, again, we're in a moment where, as Mona has said, we're in a moment of transition and change, and we're all trying to figure out what is acceptable and what isn't. And if I can just tell you a story, when I was doing the research on my book, Last Seduction, I went in to interview former President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing with a very beautiful young French research assistant. And we came out of his beautiful home in the 16th arrondissement, and she said to me, Elaine, Giscard put his hand on my buttocks, on my fess, which means buttocks. And I said, are you sure? I said, did he pinch you? Did he squeeze you? And I said, are you sure you didn't just imagine it? And she said, I think it really happened because he did it twice. Now, this is the former president of France thinking that he had the right to touch the bottom of my research assistant. And I said, you should have taken his hand and raised it up above him and said, Mr. President, could you please get your hand off my butt? Excuse me. I don't know if that's okay for public radio. Now, fast forward to now where you have a young president.
Emmanuel Macron.
Yeah, Emmanuel Macron, who's very politically correct and is extremely sensitive to all of these issues. And, you know, a grand séducteur, a great seducer in a very different way. He has recently said that French society is sick with sexism. And he cited figures, you know, a woman dies every 3 days in France from some kind of violent physical abuse. That was like 123 women in 2016. But he also said, and this is where it comes the contradiction, he said, we are not a puritanical society. And what does that mean? You know, the French have always said, oh, we are not puritanical like you Anglo-Saxons. And during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, for example, with Bill Clinton in the White House, the French laughed at us Americans saying that, oh, we just can't tolerate this kind of libido in the White House. So again, this is a real moment of truth in French society, just as it is in the United States.
Mona, I'm wondering about the Arab world. I mean, here in the U.S., it really feels like there's a sort of seismic shift going on, and it's going on beneath our feet. And from day to day and week to week, it's hard to know what's acceptable, what's not, how this is going to play out. But there's definitely a change that is happening as we speak. I wonder, are these cases in the U.S. and how they're resonating, are questions being asked in the Arab world to challenge how people have been doing things, to challenge what's acceptable? Is that happening there as well?
I would say that the moment when that happened was during the Arab Spring, especially in Cairo, when a lot of women were being harassed, whether it was when they were participating in demonstrations or just in general in the street. But I think that ever since the Arab Spring has kind of moved into the Arab Autumn and the Arab Winter, a lot of these things have just fallen by the wayside. I think, for example, though, that covering these kinds of things that are happening in the United States can be very positive for us, because in many ways it's difficult to cover these cases in the Arab world, where you have a lot of people who, even if they're accused of sexual harassment, if you mention their name, they'll threaten to sue you. Whereas in the United States, I think that it's very difficult for you to be able to sue somebody if they are covering you in a negative way. And so it's a very good opportunity to talk about things that would otherwise, in the Arab context, be considered scandalous or inappropriate. But when we cover them here in the States, it's considered a kind of perhaps less dangerous way to cover them.
Mona, I have to ask, do you worry about a backlash to the Me Too movement and to this moment that we're in about questioning male behavior, questioning kind of certain assumptions that have reigned for forever about how men can behave toward women? Do you sense any sort of backlash to that coming in the Arab world?
What really scares me is the fear that this will inspire people to do what's called the Pence rule, which is for women and men not to be together in a closed space alone. And this is happening at the same exact time in the Arab world that we're actually moving in the opposite direction, moving to have more women and men together in the workplace, especially in conservative countries. There's an opening that's happening right now, and I would be afraid that the backlash would be to more separation.
Elaine Chalino is the former Paris bureau chief for The New York Times. She's also the author of La Seduction, How the French Play the Game of Life. Mona Shikaki is a correspondent for Al Arabiya News Channel in Washington, D.C. I want to thank you both for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to turn now to another persistent issue for women. It's the wage gap. Here in the U.S., women earn about 4/5 of what men do. It's like we're working every Friday for free. You might be surprised to hear that it's pretty much the same deal in Germany, where Angela Merkel is in charge. Germany has one of the worst gender pay disparities in Europe. But in the formerly socialist East Germany, it's a different story. Valerie Hamilton reports from Berlin.
If someone in Germany calls you a raven mother, it's not a compliment. Raven mother is a female-specific put-down, a reference to the bird notorious for shoving her babies out of the nest.
This word exists only in Germany and means no good mother leaves her child very early alone.
Elke Holst leads the gender studies division at the German Institute for Economic Research in Berlin. Germany has one of the highest gender pay disparities in Europe. And that's in part because women with children often stay home or work part-time, missing out on chances for better jobs and higher pay.
Women are still expected to stay at home when a child is born for some years or only work part-time. It's more or less the duty of a woman.
But there's an exception to that rule, Germany's formerly socialist East. It started back in the old days. Under the Soviet-allied German Democratic Republic, the duty of a woman was to go to work.
Meine Mutter war keine Rabenmutter. Ich bin ganz behütet groß geworden, obwohl sie arbeiten war, oder beide Eltern.
Uta Frey says her mother wasn't a raven mother. She was just a woman with a job who took good care of her child. Frey grew up in East Berlin in the 1970s. Her mother, a teacher, worked full-time. Everyone did. Today, Frey has kids of her own, and she works full-time at a Berlin nonprofit that trains women for the workforce.
Ich bin damit groß geworden, dass es für mich auch jetzt noch eine.
She says, for her, it was always a given that a woman would go to work.
Arbeiten geht.
Before the fall of the wall, 9 out of 10 women in East Germany worked outside the home as teachers and secretaries, but also as chemists, bus drivers, and plumbers. Generations of East German children spent their early days at state-run daycare centers. There's even a classic East German children's song whose title translates to When Mommy Goes to Work in the Morning.
Wenn Mutti früh zur Arbeit geht, dann bleibe ich zu Haus. Ich binde eine Schürze und feg die Stuben aus.
Contrast that with West Germany, where until the 1970s, married women needed permission from their husbands to get a job.
When I was growing up, my only role model was my mother, and my mother was staying at home.
Melanie Alperstedt grew up in West Berlin in the 1980s. Back then, only about half of West German women worked outside the home. Alperstedt now works for Berlin's DDR Museum, which tries to explain East Germany to a Western audience. She took me on a tour through a time capsule of an East German apartment with orange linoleum floors and a big tube TV in the living room showing the news from 1984.
Guten Abend, meine Damen und Herren.
In the kitchen, there's an interactive exhibit about women in the workplace.
So why are we looking at this in the kitchen?
That's a good question.
It's not that East Germany was a feminist utopia. Women there still did most of the housework and, on average, still earned less than men.
Politicians didn't care that much about equality. They needed the women to work.
And that's still affecting economic equality today. Economist Elke Holst.
We have here in Germany a natural experiment between East and West Germany.
More than a quarter century after the fall of the Berlin Wall, women in the East are still more likely to work full-time and much more likely to have young children in daycare. If they work part-time, they work longer hours than women in the West.
And the women have a different culture. It's okay for them to work in the labor market, and they are not, as in West Germany, looked at a bad mother, as a Rabenmutter.
And that gender pay gap? In the East, it's just 6%, among the lowest in the world. There are other reasons that play into that, too. More of the jobs in the East are government jobs with fixed pay rates, rather than private sector jobs where women tend to earn less. And it's easier to find daycare than in the West, where mothers sometimes have to stay home even when they'd rather go to work.
Ich persönlich habe jetzt manchmal das Gefühl, dass sie
still, Ute Frey says, it feels like women in a united Germany have to fight for freedoms they had in the East a generation ago. When it comes to gender equality in the workplace, the West may still have something to learn from the East. But as time passes, it looks like the East is learning from the West, too. While Germany's gender pay gap overall is slowly shrinking, in eastern Germany, it's on the rise. For The World, Valerie Hamilton, Berlin.
A big thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for the Raven Call. If you're listening in Southern California today, well, that probably means you're safe, and we hope you're able to stay that way. Intense wildfires continue to burn in the Los Angeles area. The fires have destroyed hundreds of homes and forced roughly 200,000 people to evacuate. We're thinking of all of you out there and keeping an eye on the situation. Meanwhile, on the other side of the country, many Florida communities are still recovering from a different disaster. Hurricane Irma battered parts of the Sunshine State back in September. Unfortunately, it's the kind of event that Floridians are likely to see more of. That's because climate change packs a 1-2 punch of rising seas and stronger storms. The debate about how best to prepare for that future in Florida has barely begun. From our Livable Planet desk, reporter Deepa Fernandez found a town where that debate is playing out around plans for a single building.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a community on Florida's East Coast without at least one hotel. But I found one, Satellite Beach, a tiny city just south of Cape Canaveral. The city starts with its beach, of course, about 3 miles of nearly pristine coastline. There's a reef a couple hundred feet offshore, sea turtles frolic there. And on a November Saturday morning, the beach is surprisingly quiet.
This is what we call a bedroom community.
John Stone is a city building official.
The vibe here is really, for the most part, long-term residents.
This little city stands in contrast to much of the rest of Florida. It's not really a destination for seniors seeking refuge from the cold northern winters, nor does it draw many tourists. And that's partly by design.
So quite some time ago, we made some decisions. One of them is that we valued our oceanfront, and we preserved 40% of our oceanfront in conservation. So it will never be built on, whether it be a single-family home or a hotel.
In fact, Satellite Beach doesn't have a hotel anywhere. Visitors like me have to stay in neighboring cities. But the city's hotel-free days might soon be over. Satellite Beach has said yes to the construction of a small boutique hotel one block away from the beach.
We took on an aesthetic of an old Florida hotel back from the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Lawrence Maxwell is the president of Space Coast Architects.
And used that as our aesthetic, and also because it has a lot of nice environmental aspects to it.
We're on a big grassy lot where the new hotel cum apartments will be built. Maxwell says the project will deliver on what this environmentally conscious city is looking for. Something with a low carbon footprint that's extremely energy efficient and can withstand the increasingly harsh storms and floods that climate change is bringing to the region.
A new construction technique allows us to design to 200 miles an hour using about half the concrete that we would use typically.
Less concrete means a lower carbon footprint. The hotel will also be built to minimize the use of air conditioning. And on the roof, there'll be a vegetable garden and solar panels. Not exactly a big leap forward in many parts of the country these days, but still something of a novelty around here, which Jim Fenton says is pretty ironic.
We brag that we're the Sunshine State here in Florida, and people come to Florida for the sunshine.
Fenton runs the Solar Energy Center at the University of Central Florida. He points out that solar isn't just relatively clean and plentiful here. It can also be cheaper these days than some conventional sources. The Satellite Beach Hotel will be the first in this part of Florida to run on solar power. And the people involved in the project hope it will be an example to others in a region that's often indifferent to environmental concerns. Here's architect Lawrence Maxwell again.
Everything that we're doing is to be a showcase of how to do a project environmentally correct.
And it's part of a broader effort by the city of Satellite Beach to show the way toward more responsible development and preparing for the growing effects of climate change. The city's raising roads to mitigate flooding. It's moving key infrastructure, like the fire station, which keeps getting flooded. And it's carefully scrutinizing all new construction to make sure it can withstand increasingly ferocious storms. But there are some who say it's still not enough, given the climate change challenges facing the region and the world.
I don't believe we can engineer our way out of this.
Charles Kibbett is a professor of construction management at the University of Florida. He says there's just too much building of every kind going on here.
Even in Miami today, where there's, you know, the signs of climate change everywhere, there's a building boom going on, which makes, if you think about it, very little sense, but there's no negative signals being sent to make it financially difficult for people to build in these areas or even banning construction in certain areas.
At the very least, Kibbett says, new buildings shouldn't just have a lower carbon footprint than older ones. They should have the lowest impact possible, which he says the new Satellite Beach Hotel tries to do, yet there'll still be an environmental cost. But city official John Stone says not building at all wasn't an option. The plot was home to an abandoned restaurant, Residents felt it was an eyesore and wanted something done with it, but not just anything.
People said, we don't want a gas station. We don't want a fast food restaurant with the squawk boxes. They don't want that. Well, those were allowed to go there.
So instead, the city bought the land itself and proceeded full steam ahead with what residents did want, the greenest, most enviro-friendly hotel they can build. And for better or worse, finally a place visitors can stay in Satellite Beach, at least for now. For the World, Deepa Fernandez, Satellite Beach, Florida.
Let's recap. Today on the show, we heard from garment workers in Bangladesh struggling to get by, about tensions in the Middle East, and the fallout over sexual harassment in the U.S. Congress. Pretty heavy stuff. But we've got some lighter news ahead about pizza. The art of Neapolitan pizza making just got some serious recognition. It has been added to UNESCO's Intangible Heritage List. If you're someone who thinks that this specific art of pizza preparation is nothing more than slapping some cheese and red sauce onto a piece of uncooked dough, then you would be sadly mistaken. The True Neapolitan Pizza Association, and yes, there is such a thing, has published guidelines for making a proper margherita pizza. It's actually a 127-page document. But in a nutshell, here's how it works. The pizza dough has to be composed solely of water, sea salt, yeast, and flour. It must be leavened for several hours and rolled out by hand. The olive oil must be extra virgin, the tomatoes must be San Marzano, and the cheese must be buffalo mozzarella. You get the picture. Neapolitans are overjoyed with this news. Pizza maker Enzo Coccia handed out free pies in the street to celebrate.
After 250 years of waiting, pizza is humanity's heritage. It's intangible heritage. Congratulations to Naples. Congratulations.
And for Matteo Martino, the UNESCO distinction means that hopefully Neapolitans won't have to put up with any more culinary abominations.
I think and I hope that this could be the chance to make foreigners understand how pizza is made without Nutella or pineapple.
Oh, the horror. That's all for our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
And now for you nice ladies and gentlemen out there who don't understand the Italian language, I'd like to do two choruses in British. Lazy Mary, you better get up. She answered back, I am not evil. Lazy Mary, you better get up. We need the sheets for the table.
PRI, Public Radio International.